Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome everyone, welcome, welcome. Well, after a 15-year study, my first guest today has developed what she calls a spiritual neuroscience. It integrates alternative and Western medicine, spirituality, and neuroscience for innovation in treating ADD and ADHD. She's a doctor who herself has struggled with ADHD her whole life, and we're going to share her journey in just a moment and some very positive solutions for somebody suffering with ADHD. Coming up around 12:30, do you think marriage is hard work? I hear a lot of people say that it is, but after a 30-year-plus marriage and being on the brink of divorce themselves, best-selling authors and Imago Relationships founders, Dr. Harville Hendricks and Dr. Helen LaKelly-Hunt, share their expertise that they've accumulated through decades of research and countless patient counseling sessions. And they say they have 10 simple truths to make marriage simple. Who doesn't want to make things simple in today's busy world? We'll be talking to them about 12:30. But first, I want to introduce Dr. Alicia Mayer. She's a board-certified diplomat of the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology with a subspecialty certification in psychomatic medicine. Dr. Alicia Mayer is passionate about helping others understand ADHD and ADD. And in addition to her medical practice, she's taught young doctors at USC, UCSF, and UCLA. She's trained medical residents at Sinai Psychiatry and lectured on a wide variety of mental health topics. She's written for many publications, including Medscape, Psychiatric Times, Journal of General Internal Medicine. And she has a new book out, and that's what we're going to talk about today. In addition to hearing her journey, it's called From Scattered to Centered. Dr. Alicia Mayer, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, I want to share your journey with our listeners, first of all, because this is how all of this came about for you. Just tell us what you were like as a child, first of all, if you would.
Well, I've been described as a nightmare child. I had problems for as long as I can remember. I got in trouble in preschool. I think my desk was pretty much in the hallway my entire first grade year. I couldn't sit still. I was always getting in trouble. And the hardest thing for me was figuring out how all the other kids could sit still and could behave themselves. So my whole life, I knew there was something, quote unquote, wrong with me, but I didn't know what it was, and I didn't feel like I could do anything about it. Luckily, like a lot of people with ADHD, I was smart and able to get through without doing a lot of studying. My mother was extremely organized and kind of dragged me through all the studying that I did need to do. And I actually developed a fascination for the human body and how the body works. And people with ADHD can often hyper-focus on something that interests them and spend many hours at it. And luckily for me, that was anything to do with medicine I hyper-focused on. So I ended up going to medical school and doing okay in medical school, doing quite well actually in the undergraduate part and in the original 2 years where it's basic sciences. But then once we got to the clinical part where patients would just tell you their stories and I needed to be able to pick out what was important, I started having a lot of problems. So luckily I decided to go into psychiatry, and the other psychiatrists that were teaching me noticed that I was getting overwhelmed with patient stories and being able to pick out the salient details. And they diagnosed me with ADHD. Right. And then that just opened up this whole relief for me because I finally figured out what was, quote unquote, wrong with me.
Yeah, I can only imagine what that must be like for you. So I read that they stayed in intervention. Did that literally happen?
Yes, it did. It was a classic intervention with, I think, four or five of my professors, teachers gathered together and presented their case for why I had it. It was very convincing.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about ADHD versus ADD to begin with, because people often lump them together, and yeah, they're slightly different, right?
they are slightly different. So ADD is attention deficit disorder. So those are people that have trouble paying attention. ADHD is attention deficit plus hyperactivity. So they have the same problems as someone with ADD, but they also have this hyperactivity component.
Right. You know, there's been a lot of talk over the years of kids. I remember thinking back to several years ago now, I watched a show on 48 Hours, and they had gone to a town in Colorado where something like 70% of the school children were on Ritalin. Obviously, there was some kind of issue with the way people manage children there. But how would a parent know the difference between this is just a normal childhood, you know, a boisterous kid who doesn't like being told what to do versus somebody with ADHD? What would be some of the key warning signs?
Well, I think for a child, one of the most important things to keep in mind is that in order to make the diagnosis, it needs to be present in more than one area. So they can't just be having trouble at school. They need to be having trouble school, home, maybe daycare, Girl Scouts, other areas. Too often we just see problems in school and say, oh, they have ADHD, without looking at how they are in other areas. Maybe there's just something about the school that's not working for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important. And the other thing that's important, currently most of the diagnoses are made by pediatricians and family practice doctors, who are, I'm sure, trying their best and doing really well, but they're not as qualified as someone who's a psychiatrist and who's actually studied this. So I think it's important to seek out a psychiatrist to actually make the diagnosis.
Right.
Or someone else who works with people with ADHD, not someone who's just working with children in general.
Right, right. Because I remember having an assistant once who came to me to say that her general practitioner, the school teachers had said he needs to go on Ritalin, and the practitioner was ready to write the prescription there. So that's a very good point you make. We need to go to the right people there. So tell me a little bit about, let's talk a little bit more about your background, because it leads into spiritual neuroscience, as you call it. You really went on a long, long 15-year search for answers. You didn't want to just deal with medicine. I mean, you've tried all kinds of things. So you went into meditation for a while. I mean, talk to us a little bit about the journey that you went on to get to where you are now.
Sure. Well, I will be open in saying that I was on medication for quite a bit of that journey. I think it did help to ground me so that I was able to use these other things and incorporate them into my life. And then luckily, by using these other things and incorporating them, I was able to get off of the medication. So some of the things I did was for my break during my residency training, and since then, so for about 10 years, I've been going to an ashram where yogis study. They live there year-round, but other people can join for any period of time that they want, and really studied from these yogis meditation, breathing exercises, yoga. And then as well, I was also looking into not just the psychiatry portion, but the psychology portion, learning all these behavioral techniques and time management techniques, and just really applying that hyper-focus to my own condition and just everything I could think of that might be helpful, and then collecting it together. And the whole time I was doing this, I was also treating people with ADHD. So, you know, being a psychiatrist,
right,
I was treating myself and others. So I was able to try out these things on people and
right,
really figure out what worked.
And this is what makes your book so unique, because there aren't many doctors who share their own personal journey as well as case studies of you know, patients too.
Right. And it was a little difficult for me at first, because I didn't, you know, we all want to seem perfect or above reproach. And so it was a little hard to admit that I was struggling and that I had struggled with this.
I actually think that gives you more credibility.
Thank you.
That's my opinion. So let's talk a little bit about what causes ADHD. And I'm assuming that's going to be different for people, and it, you know, how it sparks off is going to be different for people too.
Well, for the actual disorder of ADHD, it's a genetic physiological disorder that has a neurochemical basis. So basically, people with ADHD process one of the neurochemicals, dopamine, differently than other people. And dopamine is important for concentration, for motivation, for these types of things. So it's a genetic physiological issue. However, we know that a lot of other things can play into it. So psychological factors, obviously growing up as a bad kid, you get a lot of self-esteem issues, mm-hmm. and the way you try to cope with that can add other problems. There's issues with diet. Certain diets obviously promote hyperactivity and the highs and lows, whereas other diets promote stability. But for the actual disorder itself, it actually is genetic and right. physiological.
Right. Now, many people aren't diagnosed until they're adults, and you share a couple of stories in the book about people who are diagnosed as adults. How do they normally get diagnosed? What normally happens? What changes for them?
Well, what I see three different types. So the first type is people whose children are diagnosed, and like I said, it's genetic, so they realize, oh, I actually had all these same symptoms growing up, but nobody diagnosed it.
Right.
Other people, their spouses bring them in. Living with someone with ADHD can be a bit difficult, so they're often dragged in by their spouses. And then the third group is people who just recognize on their own something isn't working, they're not sure exactly what it is, or maybe they've heard about ADHD, someone suggested it, and they come in to get diagnosed.
Right. No, the relief must be really intense.
Oh, it is, definitely.
You just raised a good point about, the spouse might bring them in. How does one live with somebody who's got ADHD and not go crazy?
I don't know if the second part is possible, but I think it is important for the person with ADHD to recognize that they have it. So I think for spouses where the partner doesn't recognize it is the hardest. I also think that it's important for the spouse who does not have ADHD to really understand what's going on in ADHD, to understand what is not necessarily the fault of that person or how their brain is working, how they're processing things. That can help you with communication, making things a little bit clearer and simpler, since people with ADHD often perceive everything as an avalanche of information. So that's one thing. The book is really written for people with adult ADHD, but it's been very helpful for family members who've been able to read and understand, oh, so this is why they do this, this is why they do that.
Right. You talk in the book about how frustrating it can be to have ADHD yourself, and, you might feel a lot of frustration over very small issues that other people wouldn't even think twice about. Talk to us a little bit about that and what that's like from the perspective of somebody with ADHD.
Sure. So low frustration tolerance is a big issue with children and adults with ADHD. And part of that is the issues with follow through. It's difficult to follow through and stay motivated through figuring out a task. So oftentimes people with ADHD, they know what the answer is right away,
right,
or they're not going to figure it out. And so they get very frustrated and explosive even in that frustration.
Mm. I read in the book that you said, many people get frustrated in traffic and irritated, but for someone with ADHD, that is torture.
Right. It can be completely unbearable.
So what would be some of the positive aspects of living with ADHD? It sounds as though when you're in focus, you can really get a lot done. And I would think that's one of the positives.
Exactly. Yes. And I also think that people with ADHD are often great at thinking outside of the box, perhaps because they were never really able to fit in the box before.
Right.
They're able to think outside the box. Their brains often move very quickly, so they have many streams of thought, and they can come up with a lot of ideas. So often very helpful in a work environment where they're able to generate a lot of ideas. They often have a very visual memory, so they're very good at seeing the big picture of a situation. And I think they can be energetic and fun to be around.
Right, right. So you talk about childhood neurological development. We kind of touched on that a little bit about what are concerns around that? Anything, we hear, I did a show on autism a while ago, and environmental issues were a big issue in autism today. Does any of that play into ADHD?
Well, I think the big issue with our environment today is the amount of information that we have coming in. So technology, we have information that's coming in a certain way. And I think that's making a lot of people, even without the genetic disorder, start feeling like they have ADHD and promoting some of those symptoms of ADHD. And it's just from this technology overload. So you mentioned childhood neurological development. Well, we know that the brain develops from 0 all the way up until late adolescence, early 20s. And particularly those early years are very, very important in laying down certain pathways. So when we do things like learning to read, we lay down important neurological pathways in the brain. So we wonder what is happening when children are watching television. Because if you notice, when people watch television, they zone out. It's a very passive activity. And so there's a lot of concern, not so much that the television's hurting them, but that they're not developing other pathways because, you know, all they're doing is zoning out.
Right, right. We used to be told all the time how to multitask, and it seems that people are now, you know, psychology, neuroscientists are now moving us back to don't multitask. It's not effective.
Right. The problem with multitasking, although there's several problems with it, but we tend not to do each thing as well, and we tend to get overwhelmed.
Right.
It's been found that if you're multitasking while trying to take in new information, you may take in the information, but you lay down the memory in a different part of the brain than the part that's more flexible can actually use it. So you can repeat back verbatim some information you got while you're multitasking, but you won't be able to actually use that information as well.
Oh, that's interesting. I've actually tried to stop multitasking myself. I still find myself doing it sometimes, but I found it's made a huge difference, and I seem to accomplish a lot more.
Yes, and I think that's another thing I mentioned in the book is the idea of mindfulness, mindful awareness, really being present to every aspect of what you're doing or what you're experiencing. And it can be very calming and decrease stress a lot.
Yeah, you share breathing exercises in the book. And how has meditation helped you? You might think somebody with ADHD wouldn't have the patience to sit there and meditate. So how have you managed that?
Yeah, it can be very difficult. I often start people with just 5 minutes. You know, I'll start it in the office so they can see that this is 5 minutes, and they often are like, oh, that's so much longer than I thought, because they haven't sat still for that long. But it's really important because what meditation is doing, particularly the mindful meditation, where one is just labeling things as they come up, so they're labeling thoughts as thoughts, labeling sounds as sounds. Whenever they're doing that, they're using part of the frontal lobe of the brain, which is the part that's often struggling in ADHD. So they're kind of building that muscle, so to speak, instead of the reactive part of the brain, which is where most people with ADHD operate from.
Right, right. And some of the ways that you say that we can help ourselves if we have ADHD is delegating to others, having structure, using lists, using calendars, having less stuff, which we'd probably all benefit from.
Yes.
Eating the right foods, which we kind of touched on. Is there one tip that you find you use more than others or more beneficial than others?
Well, I think they're all important. And the way the book is organized is I go through each of the 7 symptoms of adult ADHD and explain what's going on in the brain in those symptoms. And then I give exercises that can help each of those symptoms. So somebody can just kind of pick and choose which one they need. So if somebody's already doing some time management, some organization skills, then maybe we focus more on meditation and breathing and relaxation.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to you did approach this from a holistic perspective, so you also talked about medications a little. What are some of the side effects that one might expect from taking meds?
Okay. Well, the medications that I go through, I guess they're all the different types, but the main ones that are used are the stimulants, so Ritalin, Adderall, those type of stimulants. So as you can imagine, they're stimulating to the body as well. In the brain, with somebody with ADHD, they're actually calming because they process those chemicals differently. But in the body, they can have an increased heart rate, nervousness, you know, restlessness, difficulty sleeping, even tremors or shakiness.
Mm-hmm.
They have often loss of appetite, which in my adult patients, they don't seem to mind, but can be an issue in children. And then you can have, you know, even some rare serious issues, like with cardiac issues. So you want to be checked out by a practitioner, a doctor, before you use them.
Right. So how common is it that somebody truly has ADHD, Dr. Mayer?
Well, we know that it's about up to 10% in children.
Mm-hmm.
And we think at least 2/3 of them will carry it into adulthood. Only about 20% of adults have it recognized, diagnosed, and treated. only 20% of those who actually have it.
Right. So if we think we're married to someone who has it, we need to take them off to get treatment.
Yes, exactly.
So how has this helped you? How has this hindered you in your career and what you do?
Well, I think it's helped me in, like I said, being able to think outside the box, also being able to really connect with my patients. It's hindered me. It hindered me in the beginning before I recognized it and got it treated. It was hard for me to pick out the important details of what someone was saying, so everything just felt like an avalanche of information. But once I got treated and once I was able to handle that, it hasn't been an issue.
Right. And do you mind if I ask if you're still taking medication?
Do
you?
No, I'm not. I actually haven't taken it for a while now. As I said, I implemented these practices while on medication and mm-hmm. then felt strong enough to go off of it. And I've still maintained the same level of cognitive ability. So
right.
It's been great.
I think that's an important point, and thanks for sharing that, because I think sometimes people get on medication and think they have to be on it for the rest of their lives.
Right. Yes, and I would say that's not the case.
Right. What did you learn when you were putting the book together? I think, you know, we go through this journey and we look at what we've learned, the experiences we've had, and we have to come out of it changed a little ourselves.
Definitely. Well, I guess what I learned in getting the things together for the book, so and doing these practices, is how much they can affect us. And not just those of us with ADHD, but in sharing what I was working on with other people, people without ADHD started saying, oh, that actually helped me. I'm going to use that. You know, just like little things like rewarding oneself by saving their email until they've done another task. They're like, oh, that actually helped me get through that task so much more easily. So
yes.
Seeing that not only what helped people with ADHD was very helpful for others, I think was very interesting.
Right. And do you see people who never really learn to harness this energy?
I see some people who have the self-esteem issues that often go with ADHD, and it's very difficult for them. And you can imagine if you were the bad kid growing up that mm-hmm. you would have certain thoughts about yourself, and so they don't feel empowered. And this is really about self-help. It's not just about getting a pill and then everything's better, although it can be a lot better. But I think really understanding and appreciating yourself as different as opposed to defective is really important.
Right. Well, thank goodness we know more about it now, because I, you know, when I was looking through the material, I thought back to a couple of people I went to school with, and it, of course, it wasn't mentioned way back when. And, you know, maybe they could have been helped instead of being labeled the bad kid. As you said, that's a terrible label to give a kid.
Right.
So final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I'd like to just leave them with the empowerment that whether you have ADHD or you know somebody who has it and you want to learn more about it, empower yourself. Learn about the illness. Learn how it might be affecting you or the person that you love and what can be done about it, not just going to a practitioner that treats it, although that's very important, but also empowering yourself to do something with it.
Mm-hmm. And do you recommend getting second opinions if somebody is diagnosed with it?
If you don't feel that the diagnosis is correct, often I have people that come to me and it becomes very obvious and they're just so relieved. So if you feel that relief and it seems to resonate with you, then I think that's fine. If what you're being told doesn't resonate,
right,
then finding someone else is important.
Right. Well, I thank you for being so open and honest with us, for sharing your journey and your expertise. The book is called From Scattered to Centered, Understanding and Transforming the Distracted Brain. My guest, Dr. Alicia Mayer. And Alicia, what is your website?
It's fromscatteredtocentered.com.
fromscatteredtocentered.com. Thank you. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be right back. I just want to tell you before we go to break about the Northwest Dive and Adventure Travel Expo, which is coming up April 20th and 21st, which is this coming weekend in Tacoma. It's going to be a really fun expo for anybody who's into diving or adventure travel. They've got over 300 exhibitors there, 50 information seminars there. They have a cocktail reception. They have film festival down there. All kinds of stuff going on. It's going on the whole weekend down at the into Tacoma. And if you just look up, if you just Google Northwest Dive and Adventure Travel Expo, it will pop up and you can find out more about it. All right, we're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about making marriage simple. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN!
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Next Monday on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Ever wondered what it's like to pitch a business idea on ABC's Shark Tank? Seattle business owner Roger Sullivan survived the experience and will share how he took his idea in front of the sharks. Career expert Andrea Kay also joins us with insider tips on what employers are really looking for. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Clear, clean, and crisp. Check us out in digital quality sound on FM 98.9 HD3. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. You know, along my travels, I talk with many people in different capacities. And the one thing I hear when the word marriage comes up is, it is hard work. Well, my guests today are making marriage simple. They have 10 truths for changing the relationship you have into the one you want. And let me introduce them and we'll bring them straight on. Dr. Harville Hendricks, author of Getting the Love You Want, A Guide for Couples, which actually sold more than 2 million copies, has more than 40 years of experience as a clinical pastoral counselor, therapist, educator, clinical trainer, and public speaker. He has appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show 19 times. And his wife, Helen LaKelly, Dr. Helen LaKelly Hunt, was elected to the Women's Hall of Fame for her work in women's philanthropy. Harville and Helen co-created Imago Relationship Therapy and are founders of Imago Relationships International Incorporated. They have 6 children and 5 grandchildren to tell you they know what they're talking about. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, I wanted to start off a little bit because I've had many conversations with this about friends. Because I always say, well, you know, they say, well, why don't marriages last? And I say, well, you know, when marriage, as we know it, was really created, people only lived till they were 30 or 40. And now we're living till like 80 and 90. But so I wonder if you'd share a little bit about the background of marriage and what you call marriage as we know now, romantic marriage.
Well, the background about marriage is that many people may not know, but that the first million or so years of human relationships, so far as the cultural anthropologists say, there were pair bonds that probably were not formal marriages, and that the formal marriage started about 11,000 years ago when human beings settled down into villages and property became important. Households became important. Women and children became property, and marriages were arranged. And so they were arranged to support society. People did live within probably about 37 to 42, I think, is about the range, the life range at those times. But the function of the marriage was to stabilize society and to improve the status of the family and to connect people with, you know, good society and good economics. And then the romantic marriage is actually a very recent marriage. While the historians say that the romantic impulse was and has been, and there's evidence of it being around for as long as there's any sort of written record of human beings, romantic love or that romantic impulse and marriage did not get associated until about 250, maybe 300 years ago, with the rise of the democratic impulse, which allowed people to marry the people they were attracted to. So when a democracy and the democratic spirit rose, marriage then became a function of people's choices and what Helen and I say, and of their unconscious choice. So this new marriage, the romantic marriage, is the one that we all now deal with, the one that's troublesome, and the one we also think is transitioning also into a different kind of marriage. It will be still, the entry will still be romance, but the process will be very different.
The romantic marriage is about, yes, I love you, and what's in it for me? Like, we approach the romantic marriage, you and I are one. Yes, we say that, but I'm the one where, you know, once we go home, we're waiting for our partner to understand how we feel and want to care about us. And the new marriage, this partnership marriage that's emerging, is really about healing each other on the deepest level, and that there are going to be frustrations that are inevitable, but this is an opportunity to make a marriage that's a healing partnership.
Right. And you both are co-creators of Imago Relationships, Imago Therapy. You married for a very long time, but you yourselves found yourself at some point considering divorce. So talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, we just are so excited about spreading the word about healthy marriages that in a way it sort of substituted for having one.
I could see how that would happen.
Well, it really was so thrilling. And I think one of the things that makes the theory really good is both Harville and I are critical thinkers in the best sense of the word. And so we like to help each other be the best person they can be. So Harville has wonderful critique of me sort of on a daily basis. And one of my favorite things in life to do is to critique him on a daily basis because, like, who else is going to tell him what he needs to do to get better? And so
I needed to get better in a lot of areas.
So the theory is rather amazing, and Harville's rather amazing, and I'm pretty amazing, but our relationship was just so full of critique that it really was no fun.
Right.
And we really didn't feel like the marriage was thriving. And because Harville in particular is known as a world-famous marriage expert, we both knew that we really had to have a marriage that matched what the public might think.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a real wake-up call for us. In my case, I had no idea I was being negative. I thought I was being helpful to Harville.
Right.
Like, he would be glad for all the advice I was offering, but that didn't seem to be the case.
Well, let's talk about negativity. You talk about that in the book. You say it is a form of silent abuse. And tell us what you mean by negativity in this case.
Well, so let me say that there's a short and quick and simple answer to that, and that there's also a really deep and profound, almost full intellectual system that can be spelled out about that. And we don't have time for the second one
right.
on this show. So the short one is that we define negativity as whatever your partner says ouch to. And so, and I call it, Helen phrases it that way, and I say that thing that your partner, when your partner says ouch, means that they have experienced a put-down. And they register the put-down, whether you meant it or not, or whether you were conscious of it or not, if they register a hurt, then we call that negativity. Now, a put-down is literally that. It's any transaction or interaction that makes another person feel that they are less than something or someone else. Like, you know, did you lock the door? You know, and then, you know, in that could be stupid. Where were you? Or when are you? Or an eye roll? Or any negative tone of voice, irritable mm-hmm. tone of voice, any of that communicates that you're not okay as you are. So in order, because I'm uncomfortable with you, and when you have to change in order for me to be comfortable, or else I'm going to, you know, inflict you with some information that says that you're not okay as you are. So it's that sense of the put down that we call negativity, and that term negativity then covers all minor and major forms of criticism, shaming, blaming, guilting, complaining, then what John Gottman calls contempt, which shows up in the eye roll.
Right.
And we think it can go to domestic abuse, any form of violence, in fact, all the way to war. But fundamentally, it's when you make another person less valuable than you are on any scale of intensity.
Right. And interesting points you make in the book. You say that you cannot have growth in a relationship if there's negativity in it of any kind. You know, no matter what our intention, as you said, if the other person feels slighted by it. And I was really amused. And I say that with all sincerity in the way that you guys put up a sticker board in your bathroom. So talk to us a little bit about that, because I remember that Helen, I think it was, said, you know, four degrees, 10 books to both of your names, and yet you resorted to smiley faces.
Yeah. Well, the thing about negativity, when I am I'm functioning in a way where I put Harville down or he feels put down, which I'm not even aware, his defenses come up because he's protecting himself from my negativity. He doesn't want me to do a critical remark and or a helpful remark for that matter. And so it feels like I'm living with Harville, but I'm actually just living with his defenses because he's defended against me.
Mm-hmm.
For Harville to open his heart and have fun and play with me, the relationship needs to be safe. And once it's safe, the defenses go down. And one of the best things that can produce safety is humor and lightheartedness and smiley faces, like to look at smiley faces a lot. And that's why actually this book has cartoons in it, and that it's delightful to hear you say that you're amused to read blank, blank, blank. I mean, we tried to write this book in an amusing way.
Well, I think it helps you look at yourself, you know, because if you can laugh at yourself and see, oh, yeah, I do that, or, you know, I've been guilty of doing this, then, yes, it helps you put things in perspective, I think.
Exactly, exactly. So join the human race. You know, if you think that you're married to a jerk, look, everybody feels that way at times. And that's not the point anyway. You know, the point of marriage is, if you're married to a jerk, you know, what are y'all going to do about it? And there is so much that can be done.
Right. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to look at some of the things that we can do to overcome that. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guests in this segment are Drs. Harville Hendricks and Helen LaKelly Hunt, and their book is called Making Marriage Simple, 10 Truths for Changing the Relationship You Have into the One You Want. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Jones & Company Pets in Marysville, we cover the world of animals. This week, April 21st, it's the third Sunday of the month, and that means it's a Kevin and Kim Sunday. Always entertaining, Kevin McDonald and Kim Miller, medium and animal intuitive, will host the show for me. First up, they'll be talking with mobile veterinarian Dr. Penny Lloyd from Connection the Best Medicine. Then Kim will help you connect with your animal or human loved ones on this side or the other. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Tired of the insanity of other talk radio stations? Just click your radio knob and say, there's no place like Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. We are talking in this segment with husband and wife team, Drs. Harville Hendricks and Helen LaKelly Hunt. They've written another book together called Making Marriage Simple, 10 Truths for Changing the Relationship You Have into the One You Want. And if we follow these 10 truths, then marriage should be simple. But I want to ask you both. You say in the book that 90% of frustrations that we experience are from our childhood. And you said that we end up being attracted to and coupling with someone who makes us feel the same way that our caregivers did from childhood. Yeah. And when I first read that, I disagreed with it. But as I went through the book, I was like, okay, I do see what you're talking about. And you say you call that an imago match. So talk to us a little about that, if you would.
Okay. So at the beginning, we talked about romantic love briefly as the doorway to marriage, to contemporary marriage. And will probably be so for, you know, another 1,000 years, more than likely. The question is, what triggers romantic love? And what we discovered is that the romantic love trigger has to do with the unconscious perception of the similarity between certain traits and interactions of the person you're attracted to and the interactions and traits with your primary caretakers. It's all out of awareness, and now the neuroscientists call it implicit memory. That is, memory, feelings of memories of feelings that you can't attach to events. So it's just a feeling, and therefore, in the present, when you feel it, it's as though time did not exist. So because those are unresolved issues with the caretakers that are unconsciously sort of held in place and show up again in adult life with somebody who triggers those memories, what we discovered is that about 90% of what couples argue about are about unresolved issues in both persons' lives that come from the caretakers. And the way we discovered you can know that it's in the past rather than the present is whether it comes up over and over and over again. If it comes up once or twice and you settle it and you go on, then it's probably, you know, just a current disagreement. But if you argue about it, you know, 20 times, 30 times, 40 times, we even say if you argue about it more than 3 times, same issue and there's no resolution, it's because it's rooted in an unconscious childhood memory connected to unresolved issues with your parents. And that your relationship is not addressing that issue, so it continues to be a problem. And that marriage is about identifying that need that was unmet in childhood and then co-meeting that need so that you actually finish childhood.
Interesting. You say in the book that compatibility is, you know, most people think, oh, we're very compatible, you know, marriage is the next step. But you say incompatibility is grounds for marriage. So talk to us about that, if you would.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know why it's that way, but every person who tends to be a big thinker usually is attracted to someone who's a big feeler. And for some reason, we're opposite attract. And so you end up being so thrilled that you're married to someone who's different from you, but then that's the problem, that they end up different. So there's this myth in the culture that if you're struggling in your marriage, you're married to the wrong person. And I think that's the number one thing, if we could communicate, we would want the public to realize. No, if you're struggling in your marriage, it doesn't mean you're married to the wrong person. It means that some transformation is about to happen. And we think that then is a part of the healing process of marriage.
And it's the incompatibility, that is the feeler-thinker dynamic, or in mine and Helen's case, we have that dynamic. We also have a bunch of other incompatibilities we call complementarity, like Helen is a nester. She likes to be home. I like to wander. I'm very precise about time. Helen has a very relaxed relationship to time.
I love relaxed relationship. There's a man who's been married a long time.
That's what she said. So what numbers? It's almost 7. And we can list probably 15 or 20 things. Now, and that's fascinating to us, but what happens is that the tension of these polarities grows both of us because we have to accept that difference in each other, and we also have to still live together. So to live together, we both have to move from our position into a position created by the tension of those polarities. So that moves us into other potential and other potentiality. So we think that incompatibility is somehow built into nature in order to produce the energy for growth.
Mm.
If you were compatible, there's no tension, therefore no energy and boredom. And plus, if you marry the person you fall in love with, you don't have to worry about them being compatible. They will be incompatible at very deep level. The brain sets it up that way.
Well, I want to ask you to do something, if you would, and that is, you've got some great tools and great exercises in this book, and they are fun, but we literally only have 2 minutes here, but I wanted to ask if we could talk about the behavior change request. Maybe if you could do a little role play on that, to put you on the spot here. But you say negativity is a wish in disguise. Yeah. And so if we have a wish, you know, I wish my partner would do X, Y, Z, how do we approach talking to them about it?
So, Helen, I get frustrated when you take liberties with time. So my wish is that when we have an appointment to be at a place for dinner, that you would show up on time or call me if you're going to be late.
So what I'm hearing you say is that you're frustrated when I take liberties with time. And your request is that I will be on time.
Or call me if you're going to be late.
Or call.
So I can adjust my schedule.
Or call when, oh, okay.
Would you be willing to do that?
Well, yes. Yes.
Okay.
Although, are there any other options than calling you?
Well.
Because sometimes I can't find the phone.
Yes. When you are there, if you are not on time, if you would just really hug me and tell me that you miss me so much by not being there on time.
Oh, so when I'm late and I haven't called, I need to first think about when I see you, even though I'm late, going up and giving you a big hug and telling you, oh, I am sorry I'm late and I am so glad to be here right now. You're my favorite person in the world. And I'm glad I'm here now.
Or next weekend, you could take me to Paris for dinner.
Or next weekend, if I'm late, then I need to think of taking you on a trip to Paris for dinner. Okay. All right. Well, I'll be on time then from now on if I'm in charge of
it. Okay. Awesome. And hopefully that leads to laughter, because that laughter is a great healing tool, right?
It is
a serious process. I understand that. But you say in the dialogue, the goal is not agreement. It's to take turns listening.
That's right. Yes. Agreement is not possible because we're by nature different. But what we have to accept is that we are different, and then not make the other person bad because they're not us. Because that's the deepest pathology. Is to say, you're not like me, and therefore you're awful. And there's no way they can not be different, because they are different. That's built into nature. So dialogue helps you understand the other person's world and helps you enter that world and see what it's like for them there, and they enter your world. And then you move from acknowledging that there are two different worlds to appreciating it, accept it. Helen have a little scale called acknowledge, accept, appreciate, admire, adore. And then I'll take your position as your advocate.
Right.
And then you're living as partners in a relationship rather than as opponents.
I love it. And very quickly, because we've only got a minute left now of the show, but what if your partner doesn't want to sit down and talk?
Well, one of the best things to do is ask them why. And just listen, and they may say, I don't want to talk about it. And so you go, okay, I'm hearing right now you don't want to talk about it. And 2 days later, ask them again and gently ask them where it's safe for them. And until they begin to tell you, it may be hard to hear all they have to say. So another idea is, if your birthday's coming up or a special day, as a gift, ask that you go to a marriage seminar. Mm-hmm. Could be ours or another one, but say, honey, I want to go to the marriage seminar to see how I can improve. I want to learn what I need to do so that you feel happier in our relationship.
And the thing I would throw in that would be along with that line is that if my partner doesn't want to talk to me, I've probably made it dangerous for them to talk to me.
Good point.
So I would ask them, how can I make it safe for you to talk to me about something?
Excellent.
And then maybe they can tell me, well, you know, you'll have to listen and not cut me off. You have to listen and not criticize me. You have to listen and not tell me your point of view before I get mine out. So I get an idea how I made it too dangerous for them to talk, so they don't want to talk.
Well, I think you guys are amazing, and I've loved talking with you. Loved the book.
Great.
It is called Making Marriage Simple, 10 Truths for Changing the Relationship You Have into the One You Want. And people can find out more about Harville Hendricks and Helen LaKelly Hunt at makingmarriagesimple.com, makingmarriagesimple.com. We have to shoot out of here, but we will be back next week with an all-new live show. So please join us next Monday at noon. Meanwhile, you can reach me at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net, or at 800-495-7617. Again, 800-495-7617. You can ping me if you have any questions about today's show or our guests. Thanks for being with us today. See you next week. Live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.